proposed to the casino, Bob told her they were shedding no tears over Kurt.
I can see why, said Lucy, remembering the pie sale. Kurt could have been quite an embarrassment to them. He was claiming the town couldn't use the zoning regulations to keep the casino out because they'd ignored them and given Andy Brown preferential treatment.
Of course they did, said Miss Tilly. Electric signs, a talking pumpkin. It's scandalous. I never could abide Howard White, you know. He's the sort who puts overdue library books in the book return slot so he won't have to pay the fine. Sneaky, that's what I'd call him.
Lucy couldn't help smiling at this proof of Miss Tilly's willingness to think the worst of everyone.
Oh, Howard seems okay to me, said Lucy.
And he's right. It was all by the book. Brown applied for variances just the way he was supposed to.
Well, maybe you'd better do some of your double-checking, said Miss Tilly, adding a humph. If you ask me, I don't doubt for 1 minute that Howard White is capable of murder. He routinely returned books with broken backs.
I'll look into it, said Lucy. As she turned to put the heavy stock pot on the stove, Lucy's eye was caught by Elizabeth, who was making herself a cup of coffee. This was not the usual mussed-up version of herself that Elizabeth typically presented in the morning. Today she had dressed and combed her hair before coming downstairs. She had even, Lucy noticed on closer inspection, applied mascara and eyeliner. Lucy was dying to know what the occasion was, but she knew better than to ask. All would be revealed, she told herself, if she were patient. Biting her tongue, she wrapped the extra turkey meat into a neat package and tucked it in the refrigerator. She was wiping off the counter when Toby and Matt staggered in, barefoot and unshaven, in the same rumpled T-shirts and jeans they'd apparently slept in.
"Do we have any eggs?" asked Toby. "Matt and I want to fry some up."
"Sure, help yourselves." Lucy poured herself a second cup of coffee and joined the girls at the table. Elizabeth, she noticed, was watching Matt as he and Toby jostled to open the refrigerator door.
"Would you make one for me?"
asked Elizabeth. Lucy's eyes met Sarah's across the table.
"You never eat eggs!" exclaimed Sarah.
"Is that true?" asked Matt, lifting up his shirt and scratching his stomach.
"Of course not," said Elizabeth, furiously batting her eyelashes. "I love a well-cooked egg, and I bet you know how to make them just right."
"I am pretty good with eggs," admitted Matt. "Yeah, right," said Toby, handing him the box. "Just try not to break all the yolks this time." "Sure thing. Elizabeth, how do you want yours?"
"Oh, over easy," said Elizabeth, seductively drawling the words.
Lucy almost choked on her coffee. "So, what are you guys going to do today?" she asked. "Are you going to the parade?"
"There's a parade."
Matt paused, holding an egg in his hand. "Every year, Santa Claus comes."
"The elves, too," added Sarah.
"Well, that is tempting," said Matt, cracking the egg on the side of the pan. "But I think I'll pass."
"Well, if you're looking for something to do, Pam Stillings told me they could use some help at the food pantry. It's open today, and they're expecting quite a crowd." Toby and Matt nodded.
"Sure, we can help."
"I'll come too," said Elizabeth. "After all, I was the chairman of the canned goods collection at the high school."
"You were?"
Matt carefully lifted an egg with the spatula and flipped it over.
"I bet it was very successful."
"This year was the biggest ever," said Elizabeth.
That's all the time we have. Thank you for joining us for the Noon Book Hour. We hope you'll join us again Monday for our next installment from the Recording Library of West Texas.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the coronavirus update, followed by USA Today at 2.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 53 and mostly cloudy. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low in the low 50s. Then tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Good afternoon. Welcome to your coronavirus update for Friday, November 13th, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael. Coming up, I'll be reading coronavirus briefs and one short article, and then we'll bring you these pre-recorded articles. From the Texas Standard, Texas surpasses 1 million total COVID cases. Lubbock prepares for hospital overflow. Hospitals are nearing capacity as coronavirus cases surge in rural America. You can see the regret, ICU nurse on patients who failed to take COVID precautions. Public health officials face a need to market coronavirus vaccination. I come up short every day. Couples under strain as pandemic upends life at home. And brighten the corner where you are, finding a new way to be thankful in a pandemic. First, we'll look at the numbers. From the Odessa American, Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 7,945. Ector County negative, 28,963 out of 37,414 tested, with 506 pending, 129 deaths. Recovered, 6,114. Active, 1,702. ECISD daily cases, 7 students, 10 staff. Midland County, 6,213 confirmed, 105 deaths. And MISD has not updated their dashboard, and Midland Memorial Hospital has not updated their dashboard. From the Texas Tribune, average new cases increased by 767 cases compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On November 12th, 5,756 new cases were reported. Hospitalizations increased by 971 patients compared with a week ago. As of November 12th, 6,925 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths increased by 8 deaths compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On November 12th, 143 new deaths were reported. West Texas Intermediate is trading at $40.46, down 66 cents. Now for coronavirus briefs. The United States again shattered pandemic records, reporting more than 153,000 new coronavirus cases on Thursday, as some 66,000 people were hospitalized nationwide. It was the seventh time in 9 days that reported U.S. infections reached new heights. The alarming increases in nearly every state are primarily the result of small social gatherings that take place behind closed doors, experts say, including dinner parties, game nights, sleepovers, and carpools. More than 130 Secret Service officers assigned to protect President Trump have been sidelined because they tested positive for the coronavirus or had close contact with infected coworkers. The outbreak is believed to be partly linked to a series of campaign rallies that Trump held in the weeks before the November 3rd election. 18 states, most of them in the Midwest, reported record numbers of hospitalizations. Experts say the catastrophic surge in many conservative-leaning areas has its roots in a general distrust of the government that restrained public officials from imposing stricter rules. After Texas, California is now the second U.S. state to top 1 million COVID-19 cases. An influential COVID-19 model projects the U.S. death toll could reach 439,000 by March 1st. U.S. surpasses record COVID-19 hospitalizations for the third consecutive day. 67,096 people in the hospital on Thursday across the entire United States. More than 10.5 million coronavirus cases and 242,000 fatalities have been reported in the United States since February. As states ramp up restrictions, the Democratic governors of Illinois and Rhode Island are warning that new lockdowns could be on the way. Epidemiologist Michael Osterholm, a member of President-elect Joe Biden's coronavirus task force, said that paying people to stay home during a 4 to 6 week national lockdown would get the pandemic under control, but such a sweeping plan is not feasible, he told the Washington Post. Congressional Democrats said that President Trump's unwillingness to accept electoral defeat is making it harder to address the worsening crisis. Now here's one short article. Study finds more evidence that a new mutant coronavirus strain spreads more easily, but is not more dangerous. From CNN Health's Maggie Fox. Researchers say they have found more evidence that a mutant version of the coronavirus that has overtaken an older strain to spread across much of the world is in fact more easily transmitted, but does not appear to be any more dangerous. Also, because it hasn't changed its physical shape, it should be just as vulnerable to the body's immune response, whether natural or induced by a vaccine. Scientists have been reporting about this new variant of the virus, so-called D614G, since April. The research team tested the strain in lab animals and in lab dishes containing the cells that line the human respiratory tract. The variant exhibits more efficient infection, replication, and competitive fitness in primary human airway epithelial cells, they wrote. The findings validate earlier studies showing the new strain spreads more easily and support evidence the change has not made the virus more likely to cause severe disease. What the mutation may do is help the virus thrive better in the nose and upper respiratory tract, something that would help it spread among people. Now we're going to start with our pre-recorded reports today. Our first is from the Texas Standard. It runs about 10 minutes. Texas surpasses 1 million total COVID cases. Lubbock prepares for hospital overflow. Texas now has the most COVID-19 cases of any state, but some cities are disproportionately affected. Here's that report.
If you've had occasion to travel by car between cities in Texas, you've likely at some point come across a billboard expressing gratitude to those on the front lines of the pandemic. The first responders and health professionals push to the limit as they try to help others make it through. It is unsurprising to see such warm and undoubtedly sincere public displays of appreciation across Texas. Residents of the Lone Star State have a certain reputation for showing such grace under pressure, but it is that same sense of grace, perhaps, that prevents some of those first-line responders from saying aloud what many must be thinking privately. To quote one pandemic caregiver speaking to a French newspaper as that continent undergoes another devastating wave of critical COVID cases, "We do not want applause. We want people to respect the instructions." Though such a reply may dispense with sentimentality, it speaks to a reality familiar to many doctors and nurses and hospital workers across Texas. As the Lone Star State crosses the frightening threshold of 1 million total cases of COVID, more than any other state, and if it were its own country, as it once was, Texas would rank 10th worldwide in the total number of coronavirus infections. Healthcare professionals, little rested since the spring and pushed to the limit on resources, are having to face down their weariness and find ways to deal with a new wave of coronavirus infections and deaths in parts of Texas. One of those places is a city in northwest Texas, best known perhaps as the birthplace of Buddy Holly. Catherine Wells is the City of Lubbock's public health director, and she joins us now. Catherine, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
What is the state of COVID-19 case numbers and hospitalizations in Lubbock right now?
We've definitely seen an increase over the last month or so. We've had over 20,000 cases within the county of Lubbock, which is about a population of about 350,000 people.
Mortality rate, I've heard that 18,700 deaths statewide. Do you have any sense of that in and around Lubbock?
Yeah, we're unfortunately seeing 2 to 6 deaths a day, which is really significant in a town our size.
We understand that the governor is sending in resources to assist in Lubbock. Can you tell us about the situation at hospitals and what you need?
Yes, our hospitals are reaching capacity. We've been over that 15% mark now for at least 2 weeks, and they're bringing in what they're referring to as blue tents. It's what we're seeing also in El Paso. So they're setting up surge capacity outside both our major healthcare systems here in Lubbock.
So these would be outside structures, tents, literal tents?
Yeah, they're literal tents. It's to be able to hold the overflow capacity with the thought that we are going to be needing that within the next week or so.
What do you think is happening? Why are you seeing this? Are you calling it a surge, another wave? How are you thinking of it?
Yeah, I really see it kind of as our third wave. We had a lot of nursing home outbreaks early in April, and then we saw some spikes associated with bars reopening in June, and now we've really seen our largest surge since this September, October. Just more and more cases and really a high load of virus in the community, lots of community spread.
What do you think is happening? I mean, you think about that time frame, and certainly colleges and public schools reopening, although it's my sense that we haven't seen a lot of COVID-19 cases in the schools per se. So how do you read what's happening?
I really see a lot of the cases associated with activities outside of the school building or outside of the college campus. It's when people are getting together in small groups or kind of backyard barbecues, and they let their guard down. And that's really where we're seeing the spread.
What accounts for the fact that, and of course we should mention that Lubbock is a university town. You have Texas Tech, Lubbock Christian University. What accounts for the fact that the spread doesn't seem to be happening in the classroom, but in activities that are sort of outside of those places of learning?
I think when there's control and there's a teacher or professor in front of a group, I think people are very compliant with masking. And I think they stick with kind of the social distancing, the hand washing rules that we've been talking about for months now.
You have someone there, basically.
Definitely. And especially like in elementary school, my kids are great at keeping their masks on. But once they, you know, walk off that school property, you start seeing the gathering of kids, playgrounds, carpooling, sporting events. All of that contributes to the spread.
So what do you foresee in the coming days, weeks, months, as far as what Lubbock will need to get a hold on this surge?
Really need the community to be mindful and really step back and really limit interactions with people outside your family group. Big concerns about upcoming holidays and people wanting to get together. And we just have to accept that, you know, this fall's going to look different and it's not going to meet kind of what our expectations are for holidays and gatherings. And, you know, we really need to get back to the basics of wearing masks, hand washing, you know, watching your distance and really limiting those interactions with others.
Catherine Wells is the City of Lubbock's Public Health Director. Catherine, thanks again for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Let's turn now and take a broader look at what the numbers tell us about the COVID spike in Texas. Jordan Rubio is a data journalist with the Houston Chronicle, and he's been parsing through these numbers with a group of Chronicle reporters. Jordan, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We talked about how we have reached and surpassed that 1 millionth case number in Texas. Is this 1 million cases overall? We're not talking about current active cases, but a cumulative number?
Yeah, yes. So this is 1 million cases since the start of the pandemic here in Texas in March.
18,700 deaths when I last checked. It's hard to even grasp that. To be honest, is there a way of comparing that with what other states or other places have experienced?
Sure. So at the Chronicle, we do kind of our own counts every day. And so what we're seeing from deaths is about 19,000, more than 19,000, which in terms of total deaths puts us second in the nation behind only New York, which we all remember watching on the news early on with morgues outside and trucks to put in people who've died from the virus. So it's been a pretty the death toll has been pretty bad here.
We were just on the line with the health director of Lubbock. That's clearly a hot spot. Where are you, as you look at the map, where are you seeing some of the highest number of cases, numbers of cases across the state?
Oh, obviously, you mentioned Lubbock, and the panhandle has been hit very hard, but El Paso is currently where the bulk of the cases and the hospitalizations are happening. You know, there are something like 6,779 hospitalizations last I checked. You know, more than 1,000 of them are in El Paso.
What about Houston and Dallas? What are you seeing in some of the other major cities?
So in Houston, you know, hospitalizations are rising, but they're not to the point where it should be any kind of concern. But the caseloads are definitely getting a lot higher here. El Paso has been hit the hardest in terms of total cases, but Dallas and Tarrant counties are second and third, and Houston isn't far behind. So we're definitely seeing a spike in cases here in Houston and in DFW, but right now hospitalizations are not surging to the point where it looks like health systems are going to be overwhelmed.
In a sense, it's not enough to know the raw numbers, right? You have to know what they add up to. Is there any way of determining how we got here exactly, especially when you consider the numbers of cases in California, another highly populated state, but also New York, of course? How did Texas get where it is right now?
All right. So talking with health experts like Dr. Peter Hotez or infectious disease epidemiologists like Catherine Choisi, what they're saying is basically, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, if you remember, is that Texas actually wasn't affected as much as you saw in New York or California or Washington State, but because we had the 2-week lockdown. And what they're saying is that we didn't stay locked down long enough, that the state reopened too fast. And then, you know, we saw that the state reopened early, it hadn't met all the metrics that it, you know, set out to before reopening. And then cases started to spike really highly in, you know, June, July, August, before coming down. So it's really that the state reopened and it's kind of stayed open. And then we're seeing the spikes, whereas other states, you know, locked down and they took steps to mitigate the spread of the disease, which we haven't seen as much in Texas.
What is the prognosis for the next couple of months? Is there any way of tracking a trajectory here?
I personally don't know. I can't quantify any sort of trajectory, but I think the best way to put it is in the words of Dr. Hotez, which is maybe the worst is yet to come.
Jordan Rubio is data journalist with the Houston Chronicle. He and a team of Chronicle reporters have been looking into how Texas became the first state in the U.S. to have more than a million COVID-19 cases. We'll link to their latest over at texasstandard.org. Jordan, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
Now, a few reports from NPR. This first is, hospitals are nearing capacity as coronavirus cases surge in rural America.
Health officials in rural America are struggling under the weight of the coronavirus pandemic. In the upper Midwest and Rocky Mountain states, they warn that hospitals are at or nearing capacity. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports.
Here's how things look in rural America to Dr. Andrew Pavia, head of infectious diseases at the University of Utah Hospital.
So the situation really has to be described as dire.
Especially in the northern Rockies and upper Midwest states that weren't hit that hard when the coronavirus raged in American cities last spring. Pavia traces the current crisis to colleges and schools here opening back up, as did sports and most extracurricular activities. And states seeing the most new cases, like Idaho, Wyoming, South Dakota, have generally not put many restrictions in place, nor is there much enforcement on large gatherings.
Because of the local politics, they're probably not as drastic or as firm measures as we really needed to turn the tide. So I think the situation in 2 to 4 weeks is going to be grim.
Hospitalizations usually go up 2 weeks after a spike in cases, deaths a month later. And hospitals in cities like Salt Lake take in overflow patients from surrounding states, which had shortages of specialists and intensive care beds before the pandemic. In North Dakota, COVID-19 hospitalizations are up 60% over this time last month, and it's not just ICU capacity that's stretched. This week, the state said it would begin allowing medical staff who test positive for the virus but are asymptomatic to keep treating COVID patients. Here's Republican Governor Doug Burgum.
This is particularly important for us to help get healthcare workers and keep them in the game at a time when healthcare workers is the key constraint in our ability to provide care for everyone.
Burgum says some people still don't believe the virus is real. He pleaded for them to be compassionate anyway because hospitals are filling up. Kirk Ziegler, NPR News, Boise.
Now focusing on the vaccine that we've talked about so much this week, public health officials face a need to market coronavirus vaccination.
Earlier this week, the drug maker Pfizer announced its coronavirus vaccine may be more than 90% effective in preventing infection. And while the news has inspired a lot of hope around containing the virus, public health officials still need to market the vaccine. Polls show that up to two-thirds of Americans say they are unlikely to take a coronavirus vaccine if it becomes available. Sally Herships and Cardiff Garcia from our daily economics podcast, The Indicator from Planet Money, take a look at what Elvis can teach us about vaccine marketing.
The year was 1956. Polio was running rampant. People were terrified. This disease was coming for kids. The weird thing was there was a vaccine. But there were some problems.
There was a lot of fear around the polio vaccine, and that was one of the big barriers to people adopting it, is they were just scared.
Philip Graham is a marketer in New York City. He says there was this one specific group that was really stubborn, would not get vaccinated, teenagers. So an expert was brought in to help sell the vaccine. You ain't nothing but a... Elvis Presley.
This is Elvis Presley. If you believe polio is beaten, I ask you to listen.
Elvis Presley was set to appear on the Ed Sullivan Show, and he was asked, would he agree to take the vaccine in front of the press? He said, yeah, I'll do it. And a doctor from the New York City Health Department gave him the shot backstage before the show. But Elvis was part of a much bigger strategy called the March of Dimes, for which people donated small amounts of money and teenagers were involved. They did public education, they helped persuade other teens to take the vaccine, and ultimately, in 1979, polio was eradicated in the United States.
Phil Graham says when it comes to marketing a vaccine, a lot of times it isn't government figures that make the best salespeople. That's why bringing in Elvis was such a smart move.
Elvis was sort of a trusted figure that people could buy into. And yeah, why is he's not trying to pull a fast one over on me. He doesn't have any other motivations except, you know, just doing probably what's right.
We should note, by the way, that Phil is not just an Elvis history buff or a vaccine history buff. Phil was also one of the first heads of marketing for the Truth Campaign, which, in case you don't remember, was an iconic ad campaign that was launched back in 2000 that was aimed at convincing teenagers not to smoke.
The campaign was considered a major success. It got about 500,000 teenagers not to smoke. It saved billions of dollars in healthcare costs. And when it comes to marketing a coronavirus vaccine, Phil says marketers can learn a lot of lessons from the Truth Campaign.
You know, sometimes carrots work better than sticks, especially when it comes to public health messaging. And, you know, by the time the vaccine does come around and is available to everyone, we'll all have lived with it for about a year. So fear factor messaging isn't going to work because we've hopefully, you know, touch wood, seen the worst of it.
We do not yet, of course, have a vaccine for coronavirus, and public sentiment could shift once a vaccine is approved. But Phil says Elvis's work on the polio vaccine is a good example of how marketing might help sell the coronavirus vaccine once it is developed.
Sally Herships,
Cardiff Garcia, NPR News.
Now here is the first of two pre-recorded reports that focus on people in their everyday lives in confronting the pandemic. The first is, I come up short every day. Couples under strain as pandemic upends life at home.
Historically, women with families have done most of the housework in their households. Lots of studies back this up. But the pandemic is forcing couples to reconsider this. Here's NPR's Rafael Nam.
For Bianca Flostra, the breaking point came 2 months into the pandemic. She has a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, and she was starting a challenging job in international aid. And Bianca was especially unhappy with one person, her husband.
Those first couple of months were really hard. There was, I think, a lot of
a lot of fighting, a lot of tears, a lot of just trying to make it through, mostly just logistically.
Victor Udoewa was sure he was doing a lot of the housework. Half, at least, until one day, his friend asked Bianca,
"Does he do 50%? He's like, "No, I definitely do more than he does."
Bianca clearly saw things differently. She needed Victor to do more. So she took matters into her own hands.
I had to start sleeping a little bit more in the morning. So I just started to send the kids his way in the mornings.
And then came the list. The things Victor had to get done every day. Victor had the time. He's a software designer for NASA. But his job provides a lot of flexibility. So now?
I sweep twice a day because the kids in the kitchen, they mess the floor up a lot. The dishes, I'm doing dishes at least 2 times a day. Trash.
Marianne Cooper, a sociologist, says men are helping out at home more than they did decades ago. But she says women still typically do 30% more of the childcare and 40% more of the housework. It's many reasons. She says traditional gender roles are a big one. And changing that dynamic is hard.
At some point, and I've heard many women say this, it's easier and more efficient for me to do it than to voice over all the communication that would need to be voiced over for my husband to pick this up.
Not all couples can share responsibility equally. Raul Carrillo runs a law firm in El Paso. 13 employees and their families depend on him. It's a lot of work. And it often takes him away from his own family.
I feel like I come up short every day.
Raul's wife, Laura Uribarri, handles the bulk of the housework. She takes care of their 11-year-old and their 6-year-old. She also has a big job as an assistant dean at the University of Texas, El Paso, which means her daily life is intense.
The days are just nonstop, right? Because now you are cooking 3 meals and getting everybody online and trying to do your own work.
And more often than not, there are rough days. Like when they found out that schools were reclosing in El Paso only a few days after opening for the year.
I got home last night and Laura was very brittle and she was on the verge of tears. And she managed to hold that off for about 2.5 or 3 hours until the kids went upstairs to go to bed. And then she broke down. And that's absolutely the worst possible feeling.
So Raul is doing more. He handles breakfast for the kids. And when he comes home, he takes out the kids so Laura can enjoy some alone time.
Sometimes that was, you know, sort of voluntary on all of our parts. And now it's every day, absolutely mandatory.
As Laura soldiers on, she has a word of advice for husbands and fathers. And it's not sweeping the floors or setting up the IT for the children.
I would tell husbands out there, maybe every morning when you get up, ask your wife, is there one thing that I could help you with today? That's it. Just, is there one thing that would make your life a little bit better?
It's a simple question. One that Laura thinks husbands should be asking everywhere. Rafael Nam, NPR News.
And again, another report looking at close-up and personal observations from real people coping with the pandemic. You can see the regret. ICU nurse on patients who failed to take COVID precautions.
Every day since Election Day, over 100,000 people in the United States have tested positive for the coronavirus, and it's pushing the healthcare system to capacity. In many places, there just aren't enough doctors and nurses to handle the surge. In North Dakota, healthcare workers who have tested positive for the coronavirus are now allowed to keep working if they remain asymptomatic. And everywhere, nursing staffing agencies are slammed with requests from hospitals for more nurses. That's where people like Lydia Mobley come in. She's an ICU nurse for Fast Staff Travel Nursing, and she recently took a new contract at a hospital in Central Michigan. She actually left nursing about a year ago, but came back because of the pandemic.
I joined the Navy last fall,
But once I got out of active duty in October and began reserve life, obviously there's a huge calling for nurses right now. There's a huge need, and you can't really say no to that right now.
Earlier today, I asked Lydia Mobley about what she was seeing in her home state of Michigan. When I think of Michigan, this is a state that saw a lot of protests when the shutdown orders came from the Democratic governor. What are you seeing when you're walking into work, right? I mean, are people wearing masks? Do you see social distancing?
Definitely a lot more need for people to do a lot more because no, unfortunately, there's a lot of people that still don't wear masks. It's really hard to watch because at the hospital, a lot of times before they're intubated, which means put on a ventilator because they can't breathe on their own, when they're still struggling to breathe and they're saying, well, I didn't know COVID was real and I wish I'd worn a mask. And then it's already too late, but it's very sad because you can see the regret, you know, obviously, as they're struggling to breathe and it's finally hitting them that this is real. And it makes me very sad.
How common is that? I mean, how common do you encounter patients who didn't take the warning seriously?
Every shift, multiple patients, because there's a lot of elderly patients, obviously, although it's not all elderly patients. It's people in their 40s and 50s, and those are the ones I hear the regret from, that maybe they could have done more or maybe they should have realized it was more serious. But we get a lot of elderly patients who had it probably transmitted from their families, and their families on the phone are very remorseful about not doing more to keep their family members safe.
What advice have you gotten from your colleagues who have been treating this disease since the spring?
To be very honest with you, just survive. That's what they tell me a lot. Like, because unfortunately, we can't give the level of care that we could give when the staffing ratios were better. And a lot of them said, we've just been trying to survive, like keep the patients alive and keep ourselves alive. A lot of them talk about how don't ever run into a room without your PPE, even if that patient is coding, which is hard because that's your first instinct as a nurse. But again, at the end of the day, we still have to protect ourselves, even if things are very serious for the patient.
How do your workers, your coworkers, seem in terms of burnout?
Very burned out.
But what does that look like for folks who don't maybe have nurses in their lives? What does that even mean?
So burnout for nursing, I'm not sure if you're familiar with compassion fatigue, but it's similar to combat fatigue. There's irritability. Obviously, you're tired, but you're just doing the best that you can. And I think the way we get through it is just together, you know, the camaraderie and having a shoulder to lean on and someone to talk to and just knowing that you're not alone in the situation and that it's a tough time, but we're getting through it together and you're not alone.
Well, Lydia Mobley, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lydia Mobley, an ICU nurse working at a hospital in Central Michigan.
And finally, a story from NPR that's a little more uplifting than our previous reports. Brighten the corner where you are. Finding a new way to be thankful in a pandemic.
And it is time for StoryCorps this morning. For the last 35 years, a vacuum repairman in Melrose, Massachusetts, named Scott McCauley, has been hosting a Thanksgiving dinner for people who have nowhere else to go. It was a situation he found himself in after his parents' difficult divorce. Here is Scott from a StoryCorps interview recorded in 2010.
I just thought, well, there must be some other people that are in the same boat. And why should they have that rotten feeling? Why should they be stuck home alone? So what I did was I put an ad in the local paper, and I offered to cook Thanksgiving dinner for 12 people if they give me a call. So that's what I did.
Yeah, and the tradition has just grown and grown. Last year, nearly 100 guests showed up, and Loretta St. Louis was one of them. She spoke with Scott recently over StoryCorps Connect.
I was new to Melrose, and I didn't really know people here. And I saw the advertisement, I think it was in the paper, and it took a bit of courage for me to just call you.
What was your first impression of this crazy guy on the other end of the phone?
You were so friendly. I was blown away. All the care that you put into it. It felt like I was going to a family Thanksgiving event. And I'm going to miss that a lot.
Yeah, because of the COVID-19 crisis, I've offered people alternatives to us getting together.
It's nice to know that you still want to feed us, but it's the togetherness of it that's important.
You know, all the people that come, they are young and old, male, female, from different places, backgrounds, and countries. And what I find always interesting is, despite the great differences, they all have similar things that they're thankful for. And some of them will make you cry. Somebody will say, their son's now speaking to them. You know, no matter what your condition is, health-wise, financial, or newly divorced, or newly widowed, they focus for some time on good things. And I think that's wonderful.
What advice do you have for people who will be alone this year?
I would say, call everybody and anybody that you can think of. Tell them, I love you. Don't talk with your mouth full, you know. We don't want spraying turkey all over the computer screen or the phone. But connect with as many people that you think might be alone or would appreciate a call, and tell them you're thinking of them. My philosophy is, I can't fix the country or the world or even the town, but I can brighten my own corner. It doesn't matter what any of the differences that we can divide ourselves with. If your neighbor's house is burning down, you run to help. You run to put the fire out. I'm not going to sit around, talk about it. I'm just going to do something about it. And that's sort of what the Thanksgiving dinner is all about. That would be my hope for America, that everybody would just brighten the corner where they are.
Scott McCauley makes Thanksgiving dinner each year for those with nowhere else to go. He was speaking with one of his guests, Loretta St. Louis, in Melrose, Massachusetts. And if you are unable to gather with loved ones this year, you can record a meaningful conversation like Scott and Loretta did using StoryCorps Connect. Learn more at thegreatlisten.org.
And that's your coronavirus update for this Friday, November 13th, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael. Coming up, we'll have national news at 2 o'clock with USA Today, followed by local news at 3. Here's some of the articles that our volunteers are reading. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Payton to propose mask mandate for Midland. City says number of deaths up to 110 new cases, up to 6,405. And Abbott asks to deny application for nuke waste. From the Odessa American, health pros say there is no silver bullet. Odessa's COVID cases continue to climb. Permian High School throwing for empty bowls. And juniors and seniors return postponed. Those articles and more at 3. At 6, the Wall Street Journal. And at 7, a way to lighten up the week with some fun readings from our program On the Lighter Side. That's at 7 o'clock tonight. Thank you for being with us today. We hope that you'll have a great weekend. We'll be back at 1 o'clock Monday afternoon. As always on Fridays, we'll leave you with a song. Sunday was Bonnie Raitt's birthday. She was born November 8th, 1949. So we'll leave you with one of hers as we give you something to talk about. Be well and have a great weekend.
People are talking, talking. Just a little too close. We stand just a little too long.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles principally from the Harvard Health Letter. And in fact, the first article from the Harvard Health Letter, this is the November issue, is entitled, Are You Taking Too Many Medications? Peer into your pillbox. It may be time to streamline your drug regimen. Medication regimens often start simply, perhaps with a multivitamin and a single prescription drug, to treat a chronic condition. But with age and more health problems, a regimen may grow to include additional prescription drugs and dietary supplements like vitamin D and calcium, plus over-the-counter medicines to reduce symptoms such as pain or heartburn. In time, you can find yourself facing a crowded pillbox and a complicated regimen. Among people aged 62 to about 85, a third will take 5 medications per person. In the higher risk population that I take care of, those people average 15 medications per person. And some of the dialysis patients take about 20 prescriptions, says Joanne Doyle Petrangolo, a pharmacist at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. High pill burdens have led to a trend called de-prescribing, a process of eliminating unnecessary medications. There's been a huge push for more patients to cut down on their medications because of the potential downsides, Doyle Petrangolo says. The peril of many pills. It can be a hassle to take even one pill on a regular basis, but the challenge of a large drug regimen goes well beyond inconvenience. As the number of pills you take increases, so do the costs to your insurance and to you. Less obvious are the following potential problems. Side effects. The more medications you take, the more chance there is that you'll experience side effects. Medication errors. It's easier to get confused about which pill you took, so you may wind up skipping a dose or taking too many. Drug interactions. Particularly if your doctors aren't communicating with each other about what they're prescribing, or if you use several different pharmacies, you run the risk for drug interactions. Drug regimen fatigue. The more complicated a medication schedule is, the more likely it is that someone won't take the pills as prescribed. People may pick and choose what they want to take that day because they get tired of taking pills, Doyle Petrangolo says. That can mean that their disease is not properly treated, and it can produce unnecessary side effects. Quality of life. We've had some people taking medications up to 5 times a day, and they literally feel like their whole life revolves around taking their pills, Doyle Petrangolo notes. Rethinking the regimen. If you have a complicated drug regimen that is causing problems like these, you may want to consider downsizing. But don't try to simplify your regimen on your own. That can worsen the control of your condition and increase the risk of side effects. It's best to speak with your doctor or pharmacist about deprescribing. Just be very honest and say you feel like you're taking too many pills, and ask what you can do to reduce your medications, Doyle Petrangolo suggests. You could schedule a drug checkup and bring all of your medications with you in their original bottles or packages. If a virtual visit is more advisable, Be sure your doctor or pharmacist has access, likely through an electronic medical record, to a listing of all of your medications. And convey your own judgment about how well a particular medication is working, particularly when you don't think it's helping. When you are advised to start a new medication, ask for how long you need to take it. People are often started on a proton pump inhibitor like Prilosec for heartburn, but it isn't communicated to them how long they should take it, so they take it for years when maybe it should only have been a few months, Doyle Petrangelo says. Stopping a medication. In some instances, it might be safe to eliminate a pill in your regimen abruptly. For example, if you're advised to stop taking an allergy pill or an over-the-counter painkiller like ibuprofen, also called Advil or Motrin, when you no longer need it. But that's not the case with all medications. For example, if you stop taking an antidepressant abruptly, you could relapse into depression, or you could experience discontinuation symptoms that include dizziness, loss of coordination, fatigue, tingling, burning, blurred vision, insomnia, nausea, diarrhea, flu-like symptoms, anxiety, or crying spells. During this transition, maintain a pill schedule with a log or chart. Note the medication's time and dose, and check it off when you have taken it. Keep track of any new symptoms during this time. In time, you may find a streamlined regimen winds up being the prescription for a better quality of life. I had one gentleman taking 12 medications a day. We stopped two of them, and he felt like a weight was lifted. He's more inclined to take all his medications now, says Doyle Petrangelo. To hear Doyle Petrangelo discuss deprescribing with Health Letter executive editor Heidi Godman, listen to our podcast, Living Better, Living Longer. You'll find it at www.health.harvard.edu/listen. That's www.health.harvard.edu/listen. Now we're going to turn to Ask the Doctor with Dr. Anthony Komaroff, editor-in-chief of the Harvard Health Letter. How does inflammation increase the risk for heart attacks? My doctor says I'm at risk for a heart attack because a test shows inflammation. I know about high cholesterol and blood pressure, but how does inflammation increase the risk for heart attacks? Answer. I can understand why you're puzzled. In medical school, I learned that there is a simple road to a heart attack. First, cholesterol starts building up in the wall of a coronary artery carrying blood to the heart muscle. Over many years, the plaque of cholesterol slowly grows bigger. When it grows large enough that the heart can't get the blood it needs to work harder, the heart cries out in pain, chest pain, a condition called angina. Finally, when the plaque grows large enough, it blocks the flow of blood completely, causing a heart attack. It was a beautifully simple explanation. Only didn't make sense. Why, for example, did some people have a heart attack despite never having had angina? Or what about the guy who ran a marathon on Saturday, never having any chest pain during the race, finished with a good time, and then 3 days later climbed a flight of stairs, felt a squeezing sensation in the middle of his chest, and suddenly dropped dead? On Saturday, his coronary arteries had been wide open. open enough to push his heart to its max for 26 miles over 3.5 hours. But just 3 days later, at least one artery became completely blocked. Climbing one flight of stairs killed him. We now understand why. As cholesterol invades the wall of the artery, the immune system treats it like it treats other invaders. Immune system cells infiltrate the wall of the artery. They release inflammation-producing chemicals and send signals calling for other cells to come remove the cholesterol from the artery wall. Then a fibrous cap forms over the plaque. Inflammation inside the plaque can eventually eat away at that fibrous cap. If the cap ruptures, the cholesterol and the inflammatory cells and chemicals in the plaque suddenly spill into the artery, causing a blood clot to form and blocking blood flow. If even a little plaque, one not large enough to block blood flow by itself, suddenly ruptures, it can stop blood flow completely. The test for inflammation your doctor probably used, called the HSCRP, was first studied here at Harvard Medical School. And it was researchers here who showed that statin drugs work by reducing inflammation as well as by lowering cholesterol, and that drugs that reduce inflammation only and don't lower cholesterol still reduce heart attack risk. In August 2020, another drug that works only on inflammation called colchicine, Colcris or Glopyrba, that's C-O-L-C-R-Y-S, and the other brand name is Glopyrba, G-L-O-P-E-R-B-A, also was shown to prevent heart disease. So your doctor is right. Inflammation is an important contributor to heart attacks. For more information, check out the Harvard Special Health Report, Fighting Inflammation. And that's at www.health.harvard.edu/UI. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
Now, here's your forecast for